You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Lacrosse Boots. Now, if you guys haven't had the opportunity to check out the Navigator Series, it's a brand new lineup from Lacrosse. They have the Windrose for men and women. They also have the Atlas, and that's what I wore during my rut vacation this fall. Check them out. They're very comfortable. It's a traditional rubber boot, kind of mixed with a traditional hunting hiking boot. They've mashed it together, and the outcome is the Navigator Series. Check it out at lacrossefootwear.com.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back to
We're your host, Adam Keith. This is your number one resource for all things
really,
land.
Really, if you're interested in conservation, habitat management,
all the
hunting strategy, and rural real estate,
talk
this
about
is the podcast for you. Right here in this podcast today. Different features to talk about, like this property. We're all the way back driving down Interstate 70 from a consultation in kind of north central Kansas, and I had a blast today. I got Kyle and Frank in the truck, and we're all plugged in, ready to do this podcast. What was your guys' initial thoughts here, coming out of this consultation, which was one of the first real big emphasis on quail consultations that we've been able to be a part of. What's your guys' first thoughts?
Well, for me, it's that this guy's not that far off. He wasn't sure, didn't think he'd seen a covey in 5 years on one property, maybe a decade on another, and we saw a covey while we were out there, so that's a start.
That helps.
but... No, there's quail around. There's some good-looking stuff on some of the neighbors, and he's pretty close on some of his stuff. Just need to do, you know, a little adjustments here and there, but he's close. So I'm pretty excited that, sometimes you're walking into some place that hasn't heard or seen quail at all. I mean, he was saying, hey, I haven't seen a covey in several years, but he has spring birds whistling every year, so mm-hmm. We know he's in the mix, and he may even be producing some coveys but losing them in the fall and winter, so he's pretty close.
Yeah, we saw two kind of different property types today. We saw one that was heavily ag dominated, where quail were nearby, but where the potential to get a huntable number of quail based on the landscape is possible, but may be a little difficult. And then we saw a more native landscape, a couple of properties that were old native pastures. They were, I think, soil bank type pastures. So they had been native for a long, long time. They were native prairie. They were cropped, you know, way back in the 40s and 50s. And then they'd been in native since the soil bank era in the 60s. Those had really good quail potential with some tweaks. So it was cool to see quail management on two kind of different landscape types, and then how we would attack quail management based on what is there available on those two different types.
I think that that's a really good kind of quick synopsis of the day. But we're going to get really deep into the actual management of, you know, what the recommendations were for this landowner, because you hear us talk about, you know, let's say the three big wildlife types that a lot of people are looking to promote: quail, deer, and turkey. And everyone knows that there's a lot of crossover, or potentially a lot of crossover, in the management for these species. They all have, you know, different elements that they really need to persist. But, you know, there's a lot of things that they share similarities to. And this podcast specifically, as we're breaking down the property, will really highlight just how similar the management can be for a quail that weighs 6 ounces and a 150-inch deer that weighs 250 pounds. But they're still utilizing so many of the same things. And I think it's this. Hopefully this podcast is going to be able to just, again, highlight these property features, vegetation types that need to be there, and why they need to be there, but just how stinking similar it is.
Yep, a lot of that played out today. I bet it's going to be a 90%. If he does the quail stuff we're recommending, 90% of the deer practices are already in place.
Oh, yeah, right out of the gate.
There's just a couple bells and whistles to put the cherry on top, you know, if you really want to trick out the deer side. But
yeah, absolutely. So you guys have quite a bit of experience from the quail side of things in this region, as is. I've hunted this region for deer, not terribly far, and Kyle, you lived up this area for several years and managed public ground up there. So, you know, going into this, kind of had a lot of you know, expectations for the region and knew just pretty much off the bat what we were going to face. Were there any surprises to you guys once you got out there from what you were seeing? Maybe it wasn't, you know, just these properties in particular, but the actual landscape beyond the boundaries.
I was going into it knowing we were going into a good part of the world that had pretty good quail potential. Like you said, I lived up here for 8 years. I mean, we were within 20 miles of where I lived for 8 years and where I managed a lot of public land. So, but there's still some big differences in this part of the state. And sometimes you get into solid brome pasture. So I didn't know
right.
if we were going to be seeing solid brome pastures. I guess I was pleasantly surprised to see that we were dealing with native pastures.
Yeah.
So that gives us a lot easier road to hoe here. You know, we're not having to, well, we got to kill out this and try to get what we want. It's there. We've just got to graze it the right way, and we're in business. So that was encouraging.
Yeah, it was also encouraging to see that we were in a pretty quaily landscape, if that's a word. The landscape around had potential to have good numbers of birds. Several times, I know we said, looked at each other and said, hey, I would hunt that patch, or I would hunt that piece. I would hunt that piece for quail. So we were going into a landscape where quail were already pretty much a part of the landscape, and so that whatever we did or recommended on the particular property owner, we knew that quail were going to respond because they were close, and that he was already in a part of the world where bob whites are pretty secure, and that's becoming less and less of a thing in the United States, where bob whites are secure. And in this part of Kansas, they're pretty secure. We saw greater prairie chickens, which were cool.
That was a first for me.
Yeah.
You guys were like, oh, prairie chickens. And I'm like, yeah, there's that birds awesome. In the sky. I honestly would have no idea what they were as they got up out of the that big pasture there. I was like, holy crap, that's a new one for
yeah.
me.
Yeah, so you'd have stood there and not shouldered your gun if we were hunting.
No, I mean,
and
I would
Frank
just been in amazement.
Frank and I just been wailing away. Yeah.
I'll be like, hey, guys, good job, but cool.
Yeah, so cool. So that kind of tells you what kind of landscape we were in, that if we can see prairie chickens on one side of the road and quail habitat on the other side, that we were in a diverse kind of open native landscape.
And so to kind of paint that picture, guys, for you who are listening, you're like, okay, you know, there's quail there, cool, prairie chicken, that's awesome, but like, what does that landscape look like? And Frank, I asked you the question as you're like, I wouldn't be surprised at all if we start seeing or knowing that there's prairie chickens in this area. And when I asked you, okay, what is that component or why is that, you're like, the amount of grassland in this area. And you know, for you guys in Missouri who are looking to promote prairie chickens, you're talking like 10,000 acres of pretty heavy grassland component in that 10,000 acre, let's say, radius or circumference of a given location. That's what's necessary to have the prairie chicken, and we saw 16 in a flock, and sure enough, lots of grassland.
Yeah,
that's how big it is.
Right, that's the key to having greater prairie chickens is having lots of grassland, and the landscape we were in today, at least on one part of the tour, had that component, and that coincidentally were the properties that had the most quail potential.
Certainly. Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's just so cool to be in that different landscape. Like, you guys are a little more prairie setting, just where you live at compared to where Adam and I live at. And so I don't get to be in that prairie grassland situation as much as I'd like to be. So it's always a treat for me to be able to go to this portion of the world or just drive through the Flint Hills and see it all. And just kind of look out the window and drool. But yeah, it's always fun spending time in a different landscape that you know is so productive and has different critters out there that you don't normally get to experience and or see.
Well, throughout the United States, it's such an imperiled ecosystem.
Yeah.
I mean, intact native grasslands have been reduced to a fraction of what they once were, so... The further you go west, the more you get back into those still intact. But, yeah, it's a imperiled system across the U.S., and there's a lot of species that have suffered because of that. So to get to see these intact and get to see the associated species that are supposed to be there, it's, I don't know, warms my heart.
Oh, we'll imagine that.
Well, just and here's a great example. Just across the road from one of the properties where we actually saw the covey at, you looked across and part of that grassland that was, I don't know, we could see a couple hundred acres for sure, but it was very threatened by encroaching eastern red cedar. I mean, it was being taken over in a few short years. Frank, you said it, that's going to be a forest. It's not at all a grassland anymore, but it should be. And this endangered grassland ecosystem, I mean, we saw it today. Even though we were in it, we saw a lot of things that were trying to fight back and increase the amount of woody vegetation that's growing in there. And they just need to be managed because we're losing them.
Yeah,
that was depressing to see that one piece of property, and it was eastern red cedar, and they had gotten to the point where there was so little grass underneath them that fire at this point couldn't control them. So mm-hmm. Now you were at a stage where it's going to take lots and lots of expense to reclaim that grassland, and then so depending on the landowner, is that landowner going to want to put out that level of expense to control that? Well, then that just causes problems for the neighbors, because then you've got all the seeds and all the berries that are produced on those cedars. And historically, that was controlled by fire. That was a fire-dependent landscape. And that part of the Flint Hills is quite different than the central part of the Flint Hills, the big, grand, you know, grasslands. A lot of people think of the Flint Hills are pretty much free of cedars because they burn annually in that part of the world. Well, this is the northern part of the Flint Hills. There's a little more crop ground. The fire culture probably has lost there. There's not as much of the steer cattle stocking. It's more cow-calf, so fire is less of a part of the landscape, and fire has been much reduced up there, and it's very, very evident in the amount of cedars. And that's just going to cause loss of grassland. It's going to cause loss of production for the cattlemen, and then it's going to cause loss of usable space for quail and prairie chickens down the road.
Well, you brought up a great topic that will help transition us into the actual recommendations for the property and the landowner itself moving forward to promote quail numbers, increase the opportunity and the productivity of the landscape for white-tailed deer, but then overall, which I really appreciate him saying, I just want to make it better. I want to understand this land, how it functions or how it's not functioning, and make sure that down the road, long-term, I'm doing the right practices. So kudos to him for that. But Frank, you brought in the aspect of cattle, and I'll let you two kind of really talk about how cattle in this plan is going to play a really, really critical role in the actual management of hundreds of acres for this gentleman. And, you know, kind of break it down from where they're at now, what they were seeing, and then the tweaks to the actual cattle contract that's on these acres, and what that's going to do for promoting, let's say, a better grassland for species like quail, wild turkey, and white-tailed deer.
So this comes in really into play on the prairie parts of the gentleman's properties. And so right now on those two fairly large pieces of property that we look at, they were already had grazing on them. But one of them had a fairly high stocking rate, and one of them had a fairly moderate to low stocking rate. And in this particular, so let's talk about the one, Kyle, that had the fairly high stocking rate. It was a large piece of property, relatively speaking, for that part of the world. So it already had the good components for raising decent numbers of bobwhite quail. It had native grass nesting structure. It had lots of forbs. But at the level that he was stocking rat, it was probably good for production. But when we were out here with 5 or 6 inches of snow, it was pretty stark landscape.
And when you say production, are you referring to production for quail numbers?
Yeah, I'm talking about
brood
quail.
Rearing, yeah, nesting, yeah. Success, not production for cattle.
No, absolutely, right. Yeah. So from a quail production standpoint, had lots of forbs, lots of bare ground that we talk about. It's important. So they probably had quail produced there. But when we were out there today, probably wouldn't want to run a bird dog through there because we probably wouldn't find many birds.
Yeah, so he had the elements. he just didn't have them at the right levels and the right quantity. Basically, there wasn't enough residual vegetation. We're out. They just had a big snow. We drove through a snowstorm to get here yesterday. And it was obvious he doesn't have enough residual vegetation for quail to be there in this kind of weather.
So the cattle graze too much, essentially.
Yeah, they have a too high of a stocking rate. And they're not leaving enough residual vegetation. He has really good thickets on this property, had lots of wild plum, had dogwood. We even found witch hazel, just a variety, blackberries. He had the components. It's native. We're not dealing, it's native grasses and forbs. We're not dealing with brome or fescue or anything like that. So it's all there. It's just the structure isn't right for overwinter.
Right.
Maybe it's right for production, but if he's producing quail there, and we think he probably is, and hears some whistling, each spring, he's losing them to the neighbors for the fall and winter.
Well, where there was more residual cover, right. Where they would want to be, have right. to be, to make it through the winter.
And some of these neighbors, was CRP, so ungrazed mm-hmm. CRP. So to be quite honest with you, probably not ideal production acres, because a lot of those CRP acres are probably too thick to be good. Need some cattle grazing, but
sure.
That's not in the CRP options. So you got neighbor, he's losing coveys to go on the neighbors to live in stuff that's too thick to produce quail. But
during the wintertime, but yeah. In the springtime, he probably has birds.
And then they're coming on to him to whistle and make nests, and so he's putting up all the production numbers, but then losing them when he wants to hunt them. They're on the neighbors. So
yeah.
we just it's a pretty easy fix. We just got to figure out, all right, how do we keep these birds on his place for an extra 4 months? I mean, that's what we're looking at. That's the recommendations we're going to provide.
And how we would do that is we would enhance the amount of woody cover that he has. He's got some really nice woody cover thickets. Shrubby thickets, as Kyle mentioned, we would do some things to enhance that. We would maybe spread some more throughout the property. There were some parts of the pasture that didn't have it. We would recommend scattering some of that out there. But the big thing we would do is we would give him some options relative to stocking rates, and we would give him some ideas of what he can do to reduce the stocking rates to help have that winter cover available. So when he wants to, and he talked about he would love to get a bird dog. He doesn't have a bird dog right now, but he would love to get a bird dog and have the opportunity to hunt quail. Well, we want to provide him with an opportunity to manage his property in a way where he can have these birds throughout the wintertime when his hunting season is on.
Absolutely. And there's even another play into the whole cattle and the way you can manipulate or utilize the cattle as a tool. Oftentimes there's that wildlife livestock conflict on properties, but I want to really reiterate the fact that the cattle are helping improve and providing a really big component for the quail to be able to be raised and nest successfully on the property. If it was just rank old CRP grass like the neighbors, there may not be the production numbers in this region, but the cattle are helping. It just needs to, the tool needs to be utilized a little differently to have the actual successful hunts for this gentleman on that property. But it's a win-win that the cattle are part of the landscape here. And for you guys, you know, let's throw out a couple species that you guys saw that if cattle weren't there creating the disturbances, consuming some of the actual grasses there, what were the species that help the quail out that are there because of the cattle?
Oh, there was western ragweed. There was rigid goldenrod, mm-hmm. even. So
Partridge pea. Roundhead lespediza.
So there was some nice insect-attracting forbs on this site that, you know, grazing the grass is letting these forbs express themselves. So, we're not very far off from where he needs to be. Just tweak the stocking rate a little bit, and we're going to give him a couple other options that, hey, if you can't do that, there's some give and take, right? There's some mm-hmm. income needs off of this grazing contract and with his family. So if reducing the stocking rate turns out to not be an option, there's some other people that are in play with this system. So to make it all work.
Yeah, some of that can just be as in rotating the cattle through the pastures instead of them having access to the whole thing throughout the summer months. Let's utilize some of the old fence lines, all the pastures. So instead of one big one, it's three. They all got water. Let's just rotate it differently, and the cattle do different things at different times of the year in each paddock.
Yep, and we already identified those areas with him, and we'll, you know, of course, we'll put that in his plan. But those are, you know, here's option. Option one is ideal stocking rate. Option two is let's rotate through and make sure that this paddock three is the critical one. That's where most mm-hmm. your quail are going to be. That's where most of the shrubby cover, you know, however it plays out, that we graze it at this time and to this level. So
one of the key components that I want to mention, and we've already talked about it here, is we wouldn't roll in on this property and recommend no grazing. Right. That would just be shooting ourselves in the foot from a quail production standpoint. Cattle are going to have to be a vital part of his property. He could have quail with no grazing, but it would take a lot more work on his part. So we see cattle as a vital tool in this part of the world for quail management, and we fully realize that and recommend it. It's a win-win for the pocketbook, but it also a win-win for quail.
No doubt. So let's compare that to the other property where we actually put eyes on a covey, saw signs of where they've been walking through the snow just from last night. What did that scenario look like from a cattle utilization on that specific property?
As soon as we pulled in there, we identified, wow, there's a lot more residual grass and forbs. This has not been grazed as hard.
We're talking, let's say, from like mid-calf to now we're up to the knee, mid-thigh high grass.
Yeah, and not solid rank that high, but I
correct,
mean, there's
correct.
The structure. It's obvious there's at least twice as much residual vegetation from mm-hmm. the farm we were previously talking about. So we immediately, in fact, we told him, hey, this is the amount of, this is the vegetation we want to see on that other farm we just came from.
It's a great, it was a great illustration.
This is what we're after. We got to get your stocking rate on the other farm so that at the end of the season it looks just like this. And 5 minutes later, we run into a cubby. So,
yeah,
proved our point. Case closed.
Yeah, so that is a great example where, and I don't know what his situation, if it's the same tenant that rents both pastures, but the second property in most years could use maybe a slightly heavier stocking rate. I would have preferred to see a few more forbs show mm-hmm. up. Nothing drastic, maybe a couple head more.
You're being
cattle.
Picky now, is what
yeah,
you're saying.
Yeah, I'm getting down to, like, fine. This is primo stuff.
Yeah.
So perhaps there's a way of moving some cattle off the other property onto this property. You know, some things that that can be done. But as it was pretty good. And seeing that covey quail only you know, helped to emphasize that. Now, there were some things that we could do to increase or in some cases eliminate the amount of cedars that were on the property, or increase the covey headquarters that were on the property and spread them further, have them better arranged spatially. But from a grass and grazing standpoint, it was pretty good.
So another great segue. Man, you're on fire tonight, Frank.
I always am. Always am.
So this specific property, it was 80 acres, and there's kind of two defined 40-acre chunks, but pretty much had woods around each 40 acres. But in the very center was pretty thin with actually the woody cover, the covey headquarters that you're referring to. So walk us through, from a prescription and a recommendation, to increase the amount of spatial cover that's necessary for the quail, what were you guys referring to? Recommending him to do in those areas to increase the cover.
So this old hedgerow split the 240s, and the hedge trees, they're not huge, but they're beyond being useful for quail. They're too tall. So we were already recommending cutting down these hedge trees. Chop and drop provides some immediate kind of shrubby cover, edge feathering type, surrogate shrubby cover. Then also the benefits, you get some birds landing on these down trees and depositing seeds.
Just various birds, songbirds, yeah. Morning doves, whatever.
Right, and they're pooping out plums and dogwood and sumac. So over time, you get natural shrubby thickets growing up. As mm-hmm. these down trees decay, you get these natural thickets coming up. Well, then also across this 40, so most of this just had these tree rows on the perimeter, and they really didn't have anything out in the middle. So we recommended, you know, you can take the treetops out of a few of those or some of these bigger cedars and drag them out and space them out every 7,500 yards and scatter some out in the middle. They're just called down tree structures. If you want to take it a step further, he can, you know, we may recommend that he even spray out a little spot and plant some plums and then put some down tree structures around there that, again, the birds will sit on and deposit. So adding that woody component across the openness will make it more usable all year round rather than just for production, and then the birds can only use the edge where the woody cover is. So we can increase usable space year round on this just with manipulating some of the down trees that need to be cut anyway. Yeah, they need to be cut anyway. It's just moving them to different places.
So when we're talking about usable space for Bob Weiss, we're talking about the grasses and forbs, the bare ground, but woody component, the woody structure is super important. And so this 40-acre field at this time of the year, with the way the woody structure or the woody cover was spatially on the landscape, there was none out in the middle. So the middle part of that open grassland was essentially not usable space. And so Kyle and I always are talking about maximizing usable space is the key to maximizing your quail abundance. And so by creating these down tree structures or these plum plantings or these shrubby plantings within an escape distance for quail, so an escape flight So we're talking every 70 yards or so. You know, it doesn't have to be exact. You don't have to measure it, but something around that ballpark scattered throughout the landscape, then quail don't have to fly a quarter mile from one thicket to the next. We don't want that to happen. We want them to be able to get up, get out of sight, dive into a thicket, get away from a hawk, get away from whatever's after them.
I think that it's important for us to reiterate the fact, as we're talking about the property size here with this individual parcel, you know, we're talking 80 acres, okay, and then kind of just imagining, you know, that 40-acre chunk split, and, you know, we got two separate parcels, but they're still the same parcel. When we're talking about quail being there, it's not – I think it's important that we say that 40 acres and this 80-acre chunk is part of a greater neighborhood of productive acres. It's not just an isolated 40-acre chunk in – let's just say the middle of Tennessee that, oh, I've got quail now. It's important to realize that neighborhood and have the realistic expectations that, yes, there's enough surrounding birds around here that if that habitat is in place, this landowner's always going to have birds. And so if you're out there thinking, oh, I've got 40 acres I could devote to doing the same habitat work that I, you know, I want deer too, what would you guys say to that?
In this guy's case, absolutely has quail on three sides of him.
Yeah.
Three sides of this 80, maybe on four, but for sure three sides.
Adjacent, like right here.
Right here, across the road.
Yeah.
There's quail there. I'm positive. I would be willing to turn a bird dog out on three sides of this guy's
I
place,
would spend so. A day if he bet me. I would happily do that.
Yeah. So, yeah, in that regard, I don't know that there's some magical, you know, it has to be a 1,000 acres within the landscape, you know, or what that number is. But certainly, yeah, if you're going to just be in the deep in the middle of the Ozarks of South Missouri and say, hey, I've got this 140-acre open field amongst 20,000 acres of solid closed canopy timber.
Yeah.
We probably can't grow a lot of quail in that 140-acre field.
So sure.
It's all relative to the surrounding landscape. And there's a bunch of research that proves, you know, the bigger landscape effect you have, the more your neighbors have and the more management, or it increases everybody's numbers. It just makes sense. So birds can come and go and trade with the neighbors, and you're not this island population that is just waiting for a storm to wipe you out.
Sure.
You know, and then you're gone.
You have a much more resilient population.
Awesome. Well, what else, guys, was it from the consultation? What other aspects? I know one that I definitely want to hit on before we get going is the actual improving of the soil quality on the different parcel that was actually being actively farmed, the soil and water quality, because not only is that important to us to address and to recommend and point out, but it also has the recommendation has a significant factor in the managing of quail and improving habitat for white-tailed deer and wild turkey. We're getting ready to go through a toll, so if you hear background noise, ignore it.
Yeah, so on the parcel that had the ag ground, across the road from this parcel, there was some CRP grass. There was some pretty good shrubby cover. So there was probably a covey or two using that. And he has birds that are using the ag ground in the summertime for whistling, and he hears them about every year. But he wanted birds to utilize this property. So what we recommended is some connecting corridors or buffers along the edges of these crop fields. So there was a crop field edge right next to a creek drainage that would be excellent connecting corridors to connect the neighbor's native grass and woody cover and probably potential quail population over to him. And so the birds would not only come over onto his property to whistle, but they would also nest on his property and have little ones on his property and then stay the winter. So we recommended that from a quail perspective. just to be able to get quail on his property, knowing in an ideal world, if we were going to have maximized quail there, we would look at whole field conversions to native warm season grasses and forbs. But knowing that, this was this agricultural component was a huge part of their farming operation, knowing that they wouldn't agree to whole field conversions, we talked about the buffers. Well, the buffers were going to do another important component. Kyle, well, you know, I'll let you talk about that. Not only were they going to help our quail habitat and get quail there, they were going to offer some other critical ecosystem services.
Yeah, on these crop fields, they had some pretty significant erosion gullies and some pretty significant head cuts that, you know, had probably been formerly contained.
Describe real quick what a head cut is to those who are listening.
So that's that ditch, you know, that's cutting down to the creek that's got the 2 or 3 foot drop, the cliff, right?
That goes straight from the field right into the bank of the creek.
Yep. Well, then that head cut just keeps working its way further from the creek. It's always hungry for soil, and it's always cutting further back.
It's like a Pac-Man.
Niagara Falls is just a giant example of a head cut, and over millions of years, it's actually moved a long ways. But so, well, some of these cuts, these erosion gullies that used to be contained to the riparian zone are now out into the crop field.
Yep.
And that alone is not good. So regardless of the quail, sure, we want to try to make these corridors and help have some permanent habitat on this place and try to keep some quail here year-round. But, man, just general soil conservation, water quality, land ethics. So these buffer strips will filter some of that runoff.
Absolutely.
And reduce sediment going into the creek, which is good for his water quality. It's good for the neighbors downstream. I mean, these are things that, you know, he's got.
This is legacy stuff that's going to make a lasting impact.
He's talking about his kid inheriting this someday.
Yeah.
I mean, this just general land ethic, it's the right thing to do. You're going to wake up 50 years from now and be missing several feet of topsoil.
Feet of topsoil and acres of field.
Yeah, that's just not good. So these kind of practices, it filters out, you know, chemicals, it filters out fertilizer in the runoff. There's all kinds of benefits to these buffer strips and pollinators, you know, the list goes on and on and on.
Absolutely. And from the whitetail side of things, you know, a lot of the property itself, you know, the cover was relatively limited, so you can only do so much. So, you know, naturally you look at it, you're like, oh yeah, that's a travel corridor. So we're not just improving, you know, soil quality and water quality, but we're creating these large corridors to slow deer down and provide some additional cover for them to hopefully bed or the additional forage or to have a fawn and rear a fawn in, as well as nesting habitat for turkeys, brood rearing cover for turkeys and for quail as like. So it's so dynamic of that one simple suggestion, but it affects so many different aspects of the farm, and really almost every aspect of the farm from the standpoint of the income, the productivity, and then all the elements we've just been talking about.
Everything this guy wanted to accomplish with quail potentially gets met with the buffer strips. Deer, it's going to improve his habitat,
check.
Give him some bedding areas, check. Hunting strategy. Instead of just having deer pass through, now they actually stay on him more, not worried about the neighbors shooting them as much. So, yep, once again. And these are the lowest productivity acres.
Exactly.
You're not getting 200 bushel corn right next to the trees in the riparian zone. So
even in the snow today, you could look at the stubble, the density of the, whether it's bean stubble or corn stubble, and clearly see that these areas were much lower production than the center of the field. So by the time you look at input cost, evaluate that for those acres, what you're doing, the time, the energy, the diesel fuel, everything, those acres are costing you money most likely to be able to plant. and they're sensitive to the actual water and soil quality, and additional habitat can be placed there.
And the habitat we're recommending is through a federal government program that then writes a check. So
for those acres that you took out of production,
paid to not farm them, and acres that was probably operating in the red, because the input costs were probably higher than the yield.
Sounds like a no-brainer. I'm not a smart guy, but I'd do it.
Yep.
So that was a big component, honestly, of that farm. It's not obviously the only recommendation. There was a lot of TSI and a lot of edge feathering, and really any of the properties we went to had a large edge feathering component. Obviously, guys who are listening, we talk about edge feathering all the time and what it can do for the whitetail side of things, steering deer, this and that. But for your perspective, I think especially in this ecosystem or landscape, we talked about it. We were kind of down in a low-lying area, and just over time, because of the fire suppression in this large prairie ecosystem, we were seeing species of trees, let's say hedge, locust, elm species, that were, this was once open, and now it has now, they're young trees, what, maybe 20, 30 foot tall, and very low value stuff, but it was taking over prairie where fire is now not as much of a factor there in the landscape of managing it. But this whole edge feathering and chainsaw work, what is it going to do to the restoration of those acres and then for the benefit of the quail side of things?
Well, what will happen immediately is you'll get sunlight to the ground, and sunlight is an energy source. And so you're going to get an immediate flush of all of these critical forb species that are so important for the animals that we're concerned about. They provide great forage for white-tailed deer, wonderful forage. They provide screening cover and insects for turkey poults, for quail chicks, and then they provide abundant winter food for turkeys and quail. So that's going to just help restore, because those species are in the root bank, they're in the seed bank, they're just being suppressed by all these trees that are 15 to 30 years old and historically weren't there. There's some giant bur oaks that were cool, there's some cottonwoods that were there, like Kyle said, some Indians slept under this cottonwood tree sometime and that probably happened. So those trees historically were there, but the fire would have crept down into those areas and kept it free from hackberry and elm, and of course hedge wasn't an issue back then. And there would have been this vibrant forb matrix between the grasslands and this riparian area of bur oak and cottonwood. That's what's missing. That is a component that all of our species that we care about are critically need. And that's what edge feathering and timber thinning would immediately do for that property.
And when we say edge feathering, yeah, there are some areas that probably it wouldn't really be edge feathering. It would, let's say, probably classify as TSI because it's a little bit larger of an area. But a lot of it was just the edges around these streams. And it would definitely classify, and you're just basically eating back or taking back, restoring what used to be that habitat way back when. But without a doubt, we've got several species that will drastically benefit from it.
Some of those edges had, 10 plum stems there that were that were only waist high. They were just struggling, trying. I said, man, all you got to do is cut down these three trees, treat the stumps, and this turns into a perfect plum thicket. So all of a sudden, a deer lays in it or a covey of quail uses it.
I saw that many times. You roll right off that slope of basically the pasture into these areas, and 20 yards in, you still have that shrub component, but it doesn't look like a shrub, but those species are there, and it's, like I said, the single stem. And you're like, man, this could all just – I could have just walked through 20 yards of shrubs.
Yep.
If we do this work, and that's what will come back. It's right there. It's present right before your eyes. What other kind of recommendations, guys, do you guys have before wrapping this podcast up, or just general thoughts of the area or things that you saw that, you know, might be applicable to someone else who's listening to this podcast?
Well, one of the things that I saw, and I think Kyle would agree, I hope he would, that one of the things that we see...
Probably not,
just out of spite,
yeah.
Right? He would say, no, you're wrong. But we see, and on this property was the same, is just a lack of forbs. Forbs are so important. Forbs are critical for and I talked about it earlier, of all the species that we're really are concerned about. Forbs get a bad name because weeds, you know, western ragweed, you know, who wants ragweed on their property? Well, I do, because it's great. It's a great food and screening cover throughout the winter and, or excuse me, summer and late fall months, and it produces a great nutritious seed. So, but we see a lack of forb abundance and a lack of disturbance all across the landscape, and that's one of the things that we noticed on this farm, in certain places, that we can really address with some proper fire timing, some addition of fire, or some tweaks with the grazing scheme.
Yeah, a lot of properties that we see, both public and private, suffer one of two things. Lack of disturbance, so especially for quails, so we don't have the forbs and we don't have the bare ground. It's just all grass.
Mm-hmm.
Or overly disturbed. And typically that's because it's massive stocking. It's overgrazed.
Yep.
And so now we've got too much bare ground and not enough everything else. So he's really close. He's right on the spot on one property with, like we said, the grazing stocking rate and really close on another. And we had some buffer strips on the ag landscape, and I think he's going to be in good shape.
I think so, too. And to kind of – I don't want to put words in his mouth, but you guys can kind of back me up on what he said there at the end of the consultation as they're kind of parting ways was, you know, he found a lot of value in obviously having us there, this and that. But it was a further confirmation of a direction that he wanted to go and a thought that he had. And so having us there on site – confirmed everything for him, and he knew now, okay, this isn't going to be just a wasted effort. I'm close. I need to fine-tune it, and you brought a lot of things to my attention, but I really am close. There's a lot of hope, and there's a lot of effort that's going to go into this, and most likely, if I do this, from what you guys are saying, I will see the return and the value that I'm looking to get out of the property. I'll have that. I'm staring it at the face. I'm looking at it in a couple of years and knowing, hey, I can do this. And that confidence, I think, is really important to be able to supply to people when they get this plan back and they're looking at it like, oh my gosh, that's a lot of work. You have to be confident knowing that these steps are going to get you there, or really get you really close. You know, if you got realistic expectations and goals, you have to have that to get started and fuel your way through it, because at the end of the day, he's got a lot of chainsaw hours ahead of him. He's got a lot of herbicide work ahead of him. He's got cedar cutting. He's got burning. But in the long run, this is what he wants, and this is the plan to get him there.
And the reality is, hey, some of these properties, you know, it didn't get out of whack just last week.
Mm-hmm.
It took a decade or two of neglect in some cases where the cedars right. are on. So, yeah, it may take you a few years to get through the plan to get things reclaimed or back to where you want. That's just part of the deal. But that's okay. We operate on that every day.
Daily.
At work on public lands, mm-hmm. private lands. That's just part of the deal.
Yep.
Long-term commitment, but it's worth it.
That's it. Well, guys, I had a blast, and hope you guys enjoyed the consultation too. And if there's anyone out there listening that's interested in having these guys out, whether it is for a whitetail side of things, wild turkey, or the upland feature that they provide, I think everyone's going to be super happy when you guys arrive and show up on a property. It's going to be awesome. bring a lot of knowledge to the table. So if you have any questions like that, guys, reach out. Go to the consultation tab on the website and go through the contact page there. Send us an email. We'd love to get in touch with you guys and work with you and help you out, just like we did today for a gentleman in North Central Kansas. But appreciate everybody listening. And he just cut me off, didn't he?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was rude.
Let's sign off so we can stay alive.
Yeah, exactly. Jeez. Well, we're going to try and make it home so we can have another podcast next week. But appreciate you guys listening, and we'll catch you next week if we make it home safely. See ya.